This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Neil deGrasse Tyson, is an astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Natural History in New York. But that doesn't begin to tell you who he is. Tyson is a prolific writer, having authored many books and essays, and he may be the country's most frequently quoted and interviewed authority on astronomy in the popular media. He's hosted a four-part series on PBS's Nova and appeared everywhere from The Tonight Show to The Daily Show to NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. This spring, he hosts a new 13-part TV series, Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. It begins March 9th on Fox and March 10th on the National Geographic Channel. The programs recall and update the influential series Cosmos, A Personal Journey, which Carl Sagan hosted on PBS in 1980. Tyson worked with Anne Druyan, Sagan's widow, in developing the new series. Here's a moment from the first episode, which begins with Carl Sagan and finishes with Tyson.
The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be.
Come with me.
A generation ago, the astronomer Carl Sagan stood here and launched hundreds of millions of us on a great adventure. The exploration of the universe revealed by science. It's time to get going again.
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, welcome to Fresh Air. A lot of us who are old enough to have seen the original series remember it dimly, and of course you've been involved in it again. Looking back on it, what struck you about it? What did you want to honor?
Well, At the time, that was 1980 when it first aired, and I was entering graduate school in astrophysics. So Cosmos, unlike its influence on others, where it may have first awakened them to the glories of the universe or to science, for me, I was already sort of a committed student to the subject. So for me, its influence was primarily an existence proof that a scientist can communicate with the public in a manner that was very different from professor in front of a classroom or pontificating from up on high. His style was very conversational and fireside chatty. And there he was on the screen, but he was really with you in the living room. And I said to myself, if I'm ever in a position to communicate with the public on such a scale, that I would want to do it in that way.
I want to play a clip from the first episode, and in this one, you're explaining a narrative device that was also used in the original series, the cosmic calendar, which gives us a sense of the scale of the 13.8 billion years that have passed since the beginning of the universe. Let's listen.
The cosmic calendar begins on January 1st with the birth of our universe. It contains everything that's happened since then up to now, which on this calendar is midnight, December 31st. On this scale, every month represents about a billion years. Every day represents nearly 40 million years. Let's go back as far as we can to the very first moment of the universe. January 1st, the Big Bang. Far back as we can see in time, for now.
Kaboom.
I donned sunglasses for that one.
That's from the series The Cosmos on Fox TV, which will be hosted by our guest Neil deGrasse Tyson. You know, I play that in part because of that huge boom. We see you actually kind of experiencing the Big Bang, you know, the blast kind of shakes your clothing and all.
Yeah, and not getting vaporized, right? We need special clothing for that.
And somehow surviving it. And it kind of raises the question of, you know, the trade-off between kind of substance and showbiz. And I know you've done a lot of popular science education. I suspect this is something that you deal with a lot. Can you talk a little bit about how you address that issue?
Well, the very question presumes that one of the two has to be compromised for the both to be successful, and I don't agree with that premise. I think if you have not thought deeply about how to communicate science, you might get stuck saying, okay, I have to dumb this down, or I have to be flashy but with no real content. But if you really think deeply about the visualizations, the effects, the visual effects, and the content. You get to have both. And I don't think I've ever been accused of dumbing anything down. The audience knows it if you're dumbing it down. In the Cosmos series, I'm speaking real science to you, and the visualizations are supporting that real science. So, the Big Bang is as far back in time as we can see. That these are just facts. And, yeah, the cosmic calendar is an awesome way to capture the flow of events in a way that we can kind of understand better, can kind of relate to. On a cosmic calendar, our galaxy forms on March 15th. So the universe has been around for a while before we form. Our solar system forms August 31st. You can calculate this out and find out where it fits. These are visualization tools. So, yeah, I don't see that as a trade-off at all.
Right. I didn't mean to suggest that you were compromising the science in doing all
yes,
that.
Yes, you did.
No, I didn't. But what I do suspect is that there are people involved in the production that, without the diligent care, might do that. And there are probably times you've got to say, not so fast. That isn't quite right.
Oh, yeah, I'm all over him if that happens. And the good thing about the universe in this, the 21st century, we have extraordinary sources of data, the Hubble telescope and many other telescopes that are just as important but don't have quite the PR machine that the Hubble did, that inform the visualizations that we provide. So there's a limit to the freedom that an artist is given to portray things. You know, if you look at a first-run movie, they just want the thing to look good, whether or not it follows laws of physics. And occasionally I'm on top of them, too, after the fact. I commented on the film Gravity.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah, I think you did this on Twitter. Why don't you share some of the kind of scientific inaccuracies in Gravity?
Cosmos has as its priority to get the science right, above all else, and we will then tell the story with the properly represented science. In Hollywood, in the dramas that are portrayed, I think they sometimes take some latitudes, either out of ignorance or because they feel as though the truth would somehow constrain their flexibility of storytelling. And in the film Gravity, I saw that pretty early, I mean maybe day two or something, and I just felt compelled to put out, 10 tweets or so on things I thought they could have gotten right, but they didn't get right. And I phrased them mysteries of gravity, one of which was, why is it that Sandra Bullock, who's portraying a medical doctor, is fixing my Hubble Space Telescope? Get her the hell off my telescope. I, as an astrophysicist, I don't walk into her operating room and say, I got this. Open heart surgery, I'm an astrophysicist. So little things, they're just little things like that, and I was just having fun. And oh, by the way, I don't spend that much energy commenting on a movie unless I think the movie has deserved it, has earned it in particular. I don't comment on the physics errors of Star Wars, all right? You let that one go. So the fact that I even did this, for me, was quite a compliment to the film.
What are some of the most important questions astronomers are seeking answers to right now? You mentioned the subject of dark matter or dark energy, which...
Yeah, I top four. I live with these four. Okay, so we can measure the influence of this thing we call dark energy, which is forcing an acceleration of the expanding universe. We don't know what that is. We don't know anything about it other than what it's doing to the universe. Then, 85% of the gravity of the universe has a point of origin about which we know nothing. We account for all the matter and energy that we're familiar with, measure up how much gravity it should have. It's 1/6 of the gravity that's actually operating on the universe. We call that dark matter. It really should be called dark gravity. We don't know what that is either. We don't know how Earth went from organic molecules, inanimate organic molecules, to self-replicating life. We got top people working on that as well. We don't know what was around before the universe. We don't know what is at the center of a black hole. We don't know whether the universe actually is one of many in a multiverse. We want to know, is there life thriving in the under ice oceans of Jupiter's moon Europa, waters kept warm from the stress of Jupiter's gravity it's a tug of war between Jupiter's gravity and that of other surrounding moons, squeezing and pulsing Europa, pumping energy into it, melting the ice, giving us a ocean of liquid water that's been liquid for billions of years. For me, these are top questions. But my favorite question is the one that we don't even know to ask yet, because it's a question that would arise upon answering these questions I just delivered to you.
It's the scientific process. It never ends.
Yes, and in fact, at some point, as the poet Rainer Maria Rilke noted, the scientist, above all, actually, has to learn to love the questions themselves. And this is what gets people into trouble. They say, are they asking me what was around before the Big Bang? And I said, I don't know. They say, well, it had to be something. And they say, God, or they had to, and they have to have an answer. And if you're a scientist and you have to have an answer, even in the absence of data, you're not going to be a good scientist.
You've served on a couple of presidential commissions and have had some input on national science policy. How big of a priority is continued space exploration? I mean, could we get to Mars?
Yeah, one of my great concerns in the current plans for NASA, as put forth by President Obama, he always gives a great speech. So in his space speech, which he gave just a few years ago, at Kennedy Space Center, by the way. So it was all had the trappings of a real speech that'll get us into the future. He talked about going to Mars and visiting asteroids. And I'd never heard a president talk about asteroids before in the conversation. So this was all quite hopeful. And then you give the applause, and then you stop and say, well, wait a minute. What time frame did he say? Oh, the 2030s. So wait a minute. Is he president in the 2030s? No, he's back on the beaches of Hawaii by then. Well, on what budget? Well, the budget is not established for it. So then I thought, what does it mean for a president to promise a future that will be executed by a president to be named later on a budget that is not established? And at that point, I was very disappointed because I couldn't see how this would actually become reality. That's me speaking as a scientist who's a space enthusiast. But speaking as just simply an American who cares about the economic health of our country, I see one of the surest ways to bring wealth and prosperity to the country is to innovate in science and technology. And I see space as a frontier, as the greatest STEM driver there ever was, science, technology, engineering, and math. This is where dreams are made. This is what rises people out of their seat and say, I want to invent that. I want to create the airplane that flies in the rarefied atmosphere of Mars. This is what galvanizes a generation to want to become scientists and engineers in the first place. Not, we need a scientist to develop a plane that's 20% more fuel efficient than the one your parents flew. That might get some people, but that's not the stirring rhetoric that we all remember from the 1960s that made us scientists in the first place.
You grew up in New York City. Were you a science nerd as a kid?
Yeah, I would say so. It depends on how early you start the clock as being a kid. But from age 9, that probably counts. A first visit to my local planetarium, which was the Hayden Planetarium. And it took me a couple of years to realize that it was something you can make as a career. But so by age 11 onward, that's when I had the answer to that annoying question that adults ask you, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? Say, astrophysicist. And that really just shut them up. There was no comeback on that one. It's not like, oh, I know an astrophysicist. No, they don't know any astrophysicists. So that was a funny kind of little exchange there. But no, I've known since for that early. So I was a card-carrying nerd child.
You were just captivated by that planetarium show?
Oh, yeah. So I don't think I was more captivated than anybody else's first experience in a planetarium. I think every human with a beating heart remembers their first encounter with the night sky in a planetarium. The difference for me is I think the universe called me, because by the end of that experience, I was hooked ever since. I don't remember consciously saying this is for me. I think it was just became part of my bloodstream. And to a New Yorker, we have no relationship with the night sky.
Right.
If you look up, there's a building there. And you look higher up, there's still a building there. Buildings are very tall. And back then, there was not only light pollution, as there still is today. Back then, there was also air pollution. So I was struck that such a sky even existed. In fact, I didn't even believe it. I thought it was a little bit of a hoax. I know how many stars there are in the night sky. I've seen them from the Bronx.
Right.
You can't lie to me, but I'll enjoy it anyway, you know.
So I know you excelled at this and got involved in some special programs. And I read that you were recently asked to give, I think, a commencement address at, was it your elementary school, and declined. Did you feel let down by the public school system when you were a kid?
No. So everyone has all different experiences in school. I just know that throughout my life, at no time did any teacher ever point to me and say, hey, he'll go far. You know, I had some okay grades. They ran the gamut. I had some high grades in math and science and medium grades in other subjects and slightly lower grades in other subjects. You got to remember, the school system is constructed to praise you if you get high grades. And if you get straight A's, you're the one that everyone puts forward. And there I am getting grades all over the place, but I know my interest in the universe. And I owned a telescope that I bought with money I earned by walking dogs, 50 cents per walk per dog. And that accumulated quickly. I bought a camera, a telescope. I taught myself astrophotography. I took classes at the American Museum of Natural History, Hayden Planetarium, advanced classes for adults in modern astrophysics. I did all of this, but none of that showed up as a high grade on an exam in school. So there I am, and teachers complaining about my social energy as though that was something bad. And, he's disruptive. Not purposely. I just had energy, right? So my elementary school wanted me to come back, because I was already well known by then, and talk and say what a great education I had. I said, no, that's not the talk I would give. I would say I am where I am today not because of what the teachers said about me or did for me, but in spite of it. And I don't think that's what you want, so I will decline. Invite me back one day, and I'll talk just to the teachers, all right? And then I'm happy to tell them what they should be looking for, perhaps, in their students. Also consider, and now see, you got me started here. Also consider that if you have a straight A student in your class, that student has straight A's not because of teachers, but in spite of teachers. That's what having straight A means. It means you do well no matter the teaching talent of the teacher. That's what straight A's mean. So if you're a teacher and you put forth your straight A student as though you had something to do with it, you are deluding yourself. Right. The greatest teachers are the ones that turn a B student into an A student, or a failing student into a B student. Then let's talk about your teaching talents.
Having done some teaching, I completely agree with what you say there. But I wanted to ask, were you discouraged from getting into science, or maybe not taking seriously then, and even through college and graduate school, because you were African American at times?
Oh, that's in the African-American thing. So why are you staying late for the physics club when you have this athletic talent? You could be really great at that. And that happened a lot. So that's not explicitly racist. It's sort of implicitly. It's not like the stories my father could tell you, right? Because he grew up in the 30s, 40s, and early 50s. That's a whole other kind of story that he can tell you. So compared to that, when those are stories I heard, I wasn't going to complain about this. I just made sure I had a fuel tank ready to draw from to just get over and get past whatever these obstacles or absence of support was there.
I know you wrestled, I think, in high school and college, and I also
I was captain of my school's wrestling team, yeah.
And I also read that you were a medal-winning Latin ballroom dancer at the University of Texas?
Yeah, so I entered graduate school but didn't finish graduate school at the University of Texas at Austin. And I was athletic, you know, as society had expected of me. And so I was pretty limber and flexible from having wrestled. And I've always liked the art of dance. And so I was a member of two or three performing dance companies, college troops they were. One of them was a dance team that was engaged in competitive international Latin ballroom. And I was on a dance team of eight couples, and we would perform. And we were national champion in 1 year. So that was fun.
Is it true that you at one point thought about making some money by becoming an exotic male dancer?
Well, in graduate school, you're broke in graduate school, basically. And I was flexible from having danced, and I was pretty cut from having wrestled, and I also rode. And so on the dance team, there were some fellow male dancers who told me about this club where it's the ladies' club, right? But when there's the male dancers, and they said they dance, and you do the moves we do just in the normal training and for our dance performances. It's in the range of what the flexibility would be for anything else we'd be doing. They invited me because I needed more money. I was broke. So I went just to observe it, right? Say, is this something I can do? And there they came out with with jock straps having been soaked in lighter fluid, asbestos jock straps, ignited, coming out dancing to Jerry Lee Lewis's Great Balls of Fire. I said, nope, not for me. And I'm embarrassed to say that it was not until that moment when I said to myself, maybe I should be a math tutor. I don't know why I didn't think of that first. I'm embarrassed by that because, yeah, I can tutor math, I mean, and physics. And from then on, I tutored math and physics, and that's how I closed my budget.
But when did you realize you had a gift for communicating with people about science? I mean, you do this in a lot of venues and have for a long time.
Yeah, people call it a gift, and that implies you sit there and someone hands it to you. I want to encourage people to not think in terms of gifts, but think in terms of, wow, you work hard to succeed at that, because that's exactly what I do. For an example, before my first interview on Jon Stewart, now that's a tough interview right there, all right, because he's brilliant, and he's laden with pop culture referencing, and so I said to myself, if I'm going to have a successful interview with Jon Stewart, I want to study how he talks to his guests. So I sat there, and I timed how long he lets you speak before he comes in with some kind of wisecrack or a joke. And what's the average time interval of that? Is it a minute, 90 seconds, 30 seconds? And I would create a rhythm in the parceling of the information I would deliver to him so that a complete thought would come out, so that when he does interrupt, there's a complete thought and then a fun joke, and then there's a resonance to that, then where you can then move on. Yeah, no, it's not a gift.
Okay.
I work at it.
Okay. did Stewart notice that you were prepared?
No. People say, oh, you're such a natural. That's what they say.
Right.
I guess I'll take that as a compliment.
You make it look easy. Right. Okay.
Oh, by the way, this is this goes back. I mean, you mentioned a race thing earlier. Generally, I never talk about race, but you did. You remember the comparisons between Michael Jordan and Larry Bird of the Boston Celtics. When they described Larry Bird's very high, obvious talent, they say, oh, he's a student of basketball and studies where the ball is and where people are. And they talk about Michael Jordan and say, oh, he's just a natural.
Gifted
There's a
athlete.
Denial yeah. of, yeah, he's a gifted athlete. Meanwhile, he was not a first-round pick out of his college mm-hmm. or getting into college. The man worked at it. And so at some point, one needs to say, yes, black people who are talented work at what they did to become talented, all right? Rather, oh, it's just genetic. Oh, it's fast twitch muscle. It's slow twitch. Shut up. Give me a chance to tell you how hard we work at this stuff.
Well, Neil deGrasse Tyson, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Neil deGrasse Tyson is an astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium at the Museum of Natural History in New York. His series, Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey, begins March 9th on Fox. Harold Ramis, who died last Monday, was a writer, director, and actor who played a key role in several of the most popular comedies of the last half century. His list of credits includes Animal House, Caddyshack, Meatballs, Stripes, Ghostbusters, and Groundhog Day. Our critic-at-large John Powers is a fan, and he says there was more going on in Ramis's work than you might think.
Back in the 90s, I was talking to a DP who'd been working on a Hollywood comedy. He told me how he'd been fussing over a lighting setup when the director politely urged him to get a move on. This scene doesn't have to be beautiful, the director told him. It has to be funny. The director was Harold Ramis, and if there's one thing he knew, it was funny. In fact, if you think of American comedy since the 70s as a muddy playground, Ramis is the guy whose big footprints are positively everywhere. As a writer, director, and actor, Ramis worked with Rodney Dangerfield, The National Lampoon, and Second City, whose SCTV was like the brainy Sherlock Holmes of skit shows to Saturday Night Live's plotting Dr. Watson. And then there's the roll call of zeitgeist-shaping movies that virtually everyone enjoyed, from Animal House through Ghostbusters to Groundhog Day. Ramis had pop culture in his bones. As a kid in Chicago, he would get up early to watch TV on Saturday morning before the programming even began. One imagines that he was always dreaming of what might appear on screen. I suspect those dreams were anarchic, for the work that made him golden in the late 70s and early 80s, including Meatballs, Caddyshack, and Stripes, was freewheeling, often scattershot comedy, fueled by the joy of flouting authority. Ramis loved to see the inmates running the asylum. He backed the outs against the ins. This meant that his perfect actor was slouchy, wise-ass Bill Murray, who didn't merely act against authority in the movie, but like a latter-day Groucho Marx, acted against the authority of the movie itself. And because Ramis preferred showing off the individual brilliance of comic actors to making finely crafted work, he helped Murray do his thing, as he did with Robin Williams, Chevy Chase, and many others. Ramis's comic vision helped spawn everything from Steve Martin's Clueless Jerks to Judd Apatow's scabrous dialogue to the genial silliness of Will Ferrell's Anchorman pictures. Ramis was the master of the smart, dumb movie, which he could only make because he was actually one of the smartest guys around. He could fence, speak Greek, joke about Trotsky, and do the ritual drumming he learned attending Robert Bly's men's groups. Like Murray, he was always more serious than people originally supposed. The great turning point for both was their 1993 Groundhog Day, perhaps the greatest comedy of our era, which is casually steeped in philosophical notions from Buddhism and Friedrich Nietzsche. Focused, not scattershot, it's about an acerbic, self-absorbed weatherman who relives the same day over and over until he gradually learns to see and care about other people. Here, Murray's in a diner with his producer, played by Andy McDowell, proving to her that he has a godlike knowledge of everyone and everything that's going on.
This is Doris. Her brother-in-law, Carl, owns this diner. She's worked here since she was 17. More than anything else in her life, she wants to see Paris before she dies.
Oh, boy, what a... What are you doing?
This is Debbie Kleiser and her fiancé, Fred.
Do I know you?
They're supposed to be getting married this afternoon, but Debbie is having second thoughts.
What?
Lovely ring.
This is Bill. He's been a waiter for 3 years since he left Penn State and had to get work. He likes the town, he paints toy soldiers, and he's gay.
I am.
This is Gus. He hates his life here. He wishes he stayed in the Navy.
Well, I could have retired on half pay after 20 years.
Excuse me? Is this some kind of trick?
Well, maybe the real God uses tricks. You know, maybe he's not omnipotent. He's just been around so long, he knows everything.
Oh, okay. Well, who's that?
This is Tom. He worked in the coal mine until they closed the town.
And her?
It's Alice. Came over here from Ireland when she was a baby. She lived in Erie most of her life.
He's right. And her?
Nancy. She works in the dress shop and makes noises like a chipmunk when she gets real excited.
Hey!
It's true.
How do you know these people?
I told you. I know everything. In about 5 seconds, a waiter's going to drop a tray of dishes. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay?
Okay, that's enough.
Ramis followed up Groundhog Day with two sadly underrated films, Stuart Saves His Family and Multiplicity, which are also carefully conceived works about trying to be a good man. They didn't click with an audience that increasingly didn't go to comedies for lessons in how to be decent. They preferred the dumb part of smart dumb. Then again, even his early successes had been tinged with ambiguous significance. Although Ramis was steeped in the left-leaning 60s, he even dreamed of making a movie about the anarchist Emma Goldman, his comedy offered no resistance to the grand cultural transformation of the Reagan era, when gleefully bashing elites became a conservative style more than a liberal one. Like it or not, there's a lot of Ramis's DNA in Rush Limbaugh. It must also be added that Ramis, who once worked as a jokes editor for Playboy, wasn't exactly great at putting the opposite sex on screen. On the contrary, his hits were precisely the ones whose success had the unintended consequence of shrinking funny women's place in screen comedy, which largely turned into an Animal House. But I don't want to chide Ramis for what happened in the culture during his glory years. I'm here to praise him for making me enormously happy. Like a favorite uncle who perks up the family reunion by spiking the punch, Harold Ramis was one of those entertainment giants who may not seem like a great artist in any traditional sense, but whose work means far more to people than the beautiful achievements of his supposed betters. I don't know about you, but I'd rather watch Groundhog Day again than almost any Oscar winner you can name.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. Harold Ramis died on Monday. He was 69. Coming up, Julia Angwin tells us about her book Dragnet Nation, a quest for privacy, security, and freedom in a world of relentless surveillance. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. A survey a couple of years ago found that more than a third of us would rather clean a toilet bowl than create a new username and password, which we're always being told we have to do to secure our online stuff. Our guest, investigative reporter Julia Angwin, went a lot farther than that to try and shield herself from what she says is now an oppressive blanket of electronic data surveillance. From NSA sweeps to commercial services scraping our web browsing habits to all kinds of people tracking us through our smartphones, Angwin says we've become a society where indiscriminate data gathering has become the norm. Angwin has covered online privacy issues for years, and in her new book, she describes the lengths she went to try and escape the clutches of data scrapers, even to the point of creating a fake identity. Julia Angwin spent 13 years as a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. She now writes for the independent news organization ProPublica. Her book is called Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Well, Julia Angwin, welcome back to Fresh Air. Before we talk about your efforts to protect your identity and your data, let's just talk a little bit about kind of what led you to this. You say that in the book that we've sort of become a dragnet nation, a society of constant surveillance. And you write that corporate and government dragnets are inextricably linked, that neither could live without the other. Explain what you mean.
So the United States government and all governments actually do try to collect data about their citizens for all sorts of good reasons, just to want to count them in the census or know who's flying overseas or crossing borders. But they don't have the capability to pick up everything. And so what we've learned, particularly through the Snowden revelations, is how deeply they dip into the commercial databases that are being developed. So we've learned from Snowden, for instance, that the NSA is getting data from Google and Facebook and Yahoo and all the big companies that are out there. And in fact, even from things that I wouldn't have thought were worth their time, like information that flows between an app you're playing, like Angry Birds, and an advertiser that might be trying to advertise within that app. And so we have seen that these commercial databases have so much data and so granular, are so enticing to the government, that they come in either way. They, you know, the NSA has been coming to these companies with legal requests, but we've also seen evidence that they go and hack into their databases.
Why do they want to know who's advertising to me when I play a game?
You know, the thing is that the intelligence community is in a difficult position. They've been told to prevent any future terrorist attack, and that's their mission. The problem is, it's not really clear what is the way to prevent that. So they want to know everything about everyone to see if there's any indication you can learn about people who might be doing something here, and then it turns out that the algorithm shows that that's an indication that they might be doing a bad thing later. And so they're trying to gather everything, and they also want a permanent record. So let's say now they've got a lead on somebody interesting, then they can go back and look. They have it all stored there. What has he been doing for the past 2 years? What games he's been playing? Who's he been calling? So they can reconstruct the history of a person.
You write, and it occurred to me as I was reading your book, that many of us have just given up and accepted that we're going to be monitored all day, everywhere. But this is a book about your efforts to fight back and evade, you know, these dragnets. And you also decided to contact data brokers, these people who kind of scoop up and then sell and market this data, to find out what they had on you. What did you find?
Well, first of all, I found out there were a lot of data brokers out there. It took me almost a month to compile a list, because there's no real list of who are they all. And I was able to identify about 200 or so of them. Of those, very few were willing to let me see my data. It was about a dozen that would let me see my data. I obtained my data from some of the bigger brokers, LexisNexis, Axiom, and some very small outfits also were willing to let me see it. And what was shocking about it was it ranged from incredibly precise, every single address I'd ever lived at, including the number on my dorm room in college, which I hadn't remembered which exact number dorm room I lived in, to very imprecise, inaccurate things that were not at all true, that I was a single mother living with no college education, living in a place I didn't live.
Who had that?
So that one was actually from this company that is in a very strange corner of this world called alternative scoring. So essentially, they want to come up with alternatives to the credit score and score you on your data and give people who aren't the normal buyers of credit scores a way to assess you. And I found this a little terrifying, because their data was by far the worst that I'd seen about myself. And then they wanted to use it. You know, one of the uses that they described they wanted to apply to it was hospitals could use this data to assess my ability to pay if I showed up in their emergency room and they don't know who I am. And I thought, you know, I would like to have a little bit more control over that decision-making process in the hospital, and particularly would like them to have the right data about me.
Wow, yeah. You know, it might be helpful to just explain what data brokers are and kind of where do they get all this stuff and then what do they do with it?
So data brokers began by compiling very simple information from the yellow pages, the white pages, and government directories. So, you know, the property records in your state are publicly on file somewhere. The data brokers will go buy it and put it in their dossier. And then at the same time, your address is usually on file many places with magazines or newspapers you subscribe to, but also the post office sells access to its change of address list. So whenever you send in that little change of address card, your new address goes on the list. All these data brokers can buy your new address. That's why those catalogs follow you so quickly whenever you move. So that's how data brokers began. What's happening now in the digital era is they're adding to their files with all sorts of digital information so they can find out about you, what you're doing online, what you're buying online. My files from Axiom were disturbingly revealing about my online purchases. You know, they had some frequency metric of like how often I had bought underwear online, you know, which is very precise information about me. And so now these records that they have are getting much more precise. They're no longer just being used to send you junk mail that you can throw away. Now they're being used online as well to help places figure out who you are as soon as you arrive at their website. They can make an instant assessment by matching your online stuff to some of the offline data.
And I love this little detail that sometimes if you make a purchase or inquire about a price on something, there's some service that captures that fact and then auctions it in some automated instantaneous way.
Oh, yeah, right. So anytime you land on a website, actually, you may well be being sold on auction right at that second. So what happens is you arrive and the website, most websites contain invisible tracking technology from the website itself and also from up to two dozen different advertising tracking companies. At least one or two of those companies is likely noticing who you are. They see the little cookie ID, which says user number 123456 has arrived, and they go onto the auction site. It's really sort of like the New York Stock Exchange, except completely automated and happens in milliseconds. And they're like, 123456 has arrived. We know he's a man. He's looking for shoes. He's really into skiing. And then there's a bunch of bidders. And then by the time the page loads, you've already been bought and sold, and that ad has arrived just for you.
Wow. And I assume that the purchase price is pennies or fractions of them?
Fractions of pennies.
All these firms that are scraping this data and storing it, they say, I guess, that it's all anonymous, right? That it's just aggregate data. It's metadata. Can they identify us as people if they want to? And if they can't, should we worry about it?
Well, that's a great question. So a lot of the online tracking was originally justified as being completely anonymous. And so we shouldn't worry about it because our names weren't in these databases. It was just cookie number 123456 went to these websites. But there's been a lot of research that shows that basically people's traces and actions are very unique. And so when you get a large set of data that has all these very specific actions taken by people, that you can re-identify them. There was a study that really surprised me that showed that if you had four separate locations of a person where they had been over a period of a day, you could uniquely identify them. There would be only one person who had been to those four places. So what we're learning is that we can be re-identified. And in fact, much of the tracking that's going on is becoming more identified. Facebook, Google, Twitter, they know who you are already. They know your name most likely, and they are tracking you across the internet. So they also are blurring the line between the anonymous and the non-anonymous tracking.
And to the extent that government acquires these databases, they can identify an individual if they need to, because sometimes that's what they're trying to do.
The government almost always is trying to identify individuals. So most of the data they collect is identified by name. Or if it isn't immediately identified by name, it can be identified.
All right. So you want to make your information profile more secure, and one of the first things you want to do is secure your computer. And we're always being told, you know, choose complicated passwords, change them frequently, which we hate to hear because then we can't remember the passwords. How did you deal with that? What did you do about password security on your computer?
Yeah, passwords is such a Gordian knot because you're told to make them really hard to remember and not write them down and have different ones for every website, which is basically impossible. So then what everyone does is have the same password. So the most popular password by far is 123456. It's a terrible password. You're going to get cracked and hacked. But I myself was victim to this. It's very hard to think of new passwords. So essentially I realized I had to give up on trying to think of new passwords. I came up with two different strategies. One was I used a password manager to come up with the passwords for me. And so I did that for a vast majority of sites that I didn't care that much about. But for banking and email and actually my password to my password manager, I wanted something that I had made up myself, but I still didn't want to have to think of it. So I came up with this very interesting strategy, which is a system called Diceware. It's basically a way to pick random words from the dictionary and string them together to make a very long, difficult-to-break password. The reason you have to pick random words from the dictionary is that if you pick words from your mind, they're most likely to be associated. So as soon as you pick unicorn, you're probably going to pick fairy. And computers are very good at guessing what we think in our mind is going to be random. So picking them truly randomly from the dictionary is a very good way to have an unbreakable password.
Wow. Okay, so you have a password manager that generates a bunch of gobbledygook passwords for a bunch of sites that you don't use frequently. But then you need a password for your password manager, and you have this system for developing this kind of secure password. What do you do with that? Do you write it down?
I do write my passwords down because those passwords, I only have about 5 to 10 that are super long, and for my email and banking and password manager, they can be written down because I'm not particularly worried about somebody breaking into my house, taking a piece of paper on which a random string of words is written, and then trying to figure out what account I might have used that password for. I feel like that is the threat I need to worry about least. And so I've decided that that's the best way for me to manage my passwords.
Okay, but what do you do when you're at a different computer at your friend's house or someplace else? Do you carry that piece of paper with you?
I do. It's in my wallet. Don't tell anyone.
Okay, good. cell phones is another issue. First of all, what kind of information are people getting from our cell phones?
Everything you can get from our cell phones these days because we do everything on our cell phones, right? So first of all, we bring them in our room and sleep next to them. So our location is always being transmitted, not just to the cell phone company, but to many of the apps, to the company that makes your phone, and possibly advertisers who are inside the apps or inside the phone in other ways. And so there are a lot of people who are getting your location. And then they also, many of them can see what you're looking for, what you're searching for online, or which apps you're using, what time you set your alarm clock for. Basically, anything you do on there is being transmitted to somebody.
So what did you decide to do about that?
I tried two things. I tried having a burner phone, which basically was a phone not tied to my identity, so that at the very least I could do all those things without it being tied to my identity.
And that's a prepaid disposable phone, right? You can
yes, and right. I tried using a prepaid disposable phone for many of those things. I also installed all sorts of software to protect my privacy on the phone. So I had this thing called Tor that would route my internet traffic through other places so it would look like I was in a different location than I really was. I installed some encryption software that would scramble my calls so they couldn't be listened to by anyone, and I installed that same encryption for texting. The problem with those was I had to convince other people on the other end to use the same software to communicate with me. So it was kind of a lonely existence.
Now, you said that there's this software, I think it's called Tor, which will, when you execute an internet search, route it through different countries, so it's harder to tell where you are, right?
Yeah. I was sitting in a cafe in New York, and Tor made it look like I was sitting in Amsterdam.
Right. Now, does it slow down the searches?
It's very slow. The problem is you're sitting in a cafe in New York and you're running your searches out of Amsterdam. So this is the problem. The price of privacy is rather high. So when I timed my searches on Tor, they took at least double, many times, 4 or 5 times longer than it would have taken not on tour.
So I'm interested in kind of your reflections on this whole experience. How much did you were you able to protect yourself? Do you know?
I wasn't that successful. I mean, I would say I probably protected myself at most 50% of what is possible. And that's because I wasn't willing to live in a cage and, you know, in a tin shed in the woods, because I wanted to live in the modern world. And there's a price you pay for living in the modern world. And some of that has to do with you have to share your data. But I also felt that it didn't have to be that way. I would have been happy to buy some services like email and a better search engine and a cell phone that wouldn't track me. And I wasn't able to buy those things. And so I felt that there was a lack of a market for privacy. I also felt there was a lack of laws, because I felt it was unfair for these data brokers to hold all this information, not let me see it, and not let me remove it.
You know, you've been writing about these privacy issues for a long time now. And you write that when you go to an airport, you insist on a pat-down rather than go through the body scanner. Why?
I want there to be metrics about the fact that people don't want dragnets. I mean, the body scanners are essentially dragnets. They're indiscriminate surveillance. Everybody has to go through it. And then it's data that's stored somewhere and kept forever. Like all of these dragnets, I'm concerned not only about the moment they're collected, but the fact that they're going to live on. I don't want there to be an image of my naked body in some government database. They've already got enough about me. So I go for the pat down because there's no record of that. It's actually more invasive. They stick your hands in your pants. You know, it's no fun. But I allow myself half an hour every time because I want there to be a number out there which says people aren't choosing this. And I actually felt good. The other day I was at an airport in Denver, I think, where there was a sign in the line at TSA, and it said 95% of people choose to go through the body scanner. And I thought, aha, I'm part of the 5%, and I am very proud of that.
Well, Julia Angwin, thanks so much. It's been interesting.
Thank you so much.
Julia Angwin writes for the independent news organization ProPublica. Her new book is Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.